is only creating tensions, and it lives and it survives on tension. I mean, they feed on tension. They feed on crises that they create all over the world. That's what they feed on. So this is such a move that exists there. There are some mafia networks that are of power inside the United States. And the crises in the world, you know, they feed on all those crises and they take advantage of them. So basically, the United States is a mafia regime. America is a mafia regime. Political mafia, economic mafia, you know, weapon manufacturing mafia. You know, a whole different kinds of mafia that have the power in that country and lead things, and they have different affairs of the country, and under their thumb, they appoint people, they remove people from their posts, or they bring presidents to power, these mafias. So, and then when you see this mafia-based regime, they require in different parts of the world to face crises. So that's what they do. They create sources of crisis. In West Asia, you see, how many crises they've created? Well, they require a creature like Daesh or ISIS, that's their own trained pet. And explicitly and openly, you know, they had videos and they simply beheaded the people on camera or burned them alive or simply drowned them, and then they would have spread out the video to the world. This is what America created. They confessed, they admitted this, that this is their own creation. They are just creating tension. So if they are not able to create tension, then they have the arms manufacturing companies cannot make maximum profit. So they have to create tension and crisis in the world so that the interests of this mafia so would be maximized. Well, today, in my opinion, Ukraine is also a victim of the same policy. Now, what's happening in Ukraine these days, they have to do with the very same policies of the United States. The United States pushed Ukraine to this point. It was America that intervened and meddled in the domestic affairs of that country, and they had gatherings and events against the governments, that, you know, creating this purple revolution, making color coup d'etats, and then the presence of American senators inside different opposition the forums, appointing this government and removing the other government. You know, this is what will end up in the same thing. Of course, we're against destruction and war, no matter where in the world. This is what we have always emphasized. The killing of the people, the destruction of the country's infrastructure, these are what we do not approve of, no matter where they happen in the world. This is what we have always talked about. We are not just like Westerners. When there is a bomb that they drop on in Afghanistan and they target a wedding group and they turn the wedding into a mourning, this is what they call fight against terrorism. It's not a crime in their opinion. This is their logic in the West. In Afghanistan, in Iraq, America, what is it doing in eastern Syria? Why are they plundering Syrian resources, Syrian oil? Why do they steal Afghan money and funds? It's the national wealth of the Afghans that they have confiscated and seized. In West Asia, the crimes that the Zionists are committing every day and night. Why do they defend those crimes? These are tension creating and given rise to crises. And this is what they do, and they're all done in the name of defending human rights and such issues. We unlike them, if we see something happen somewhere that we favor, we would not judge it differently than when it happens elsewhere. For 8 years, the people of Yemen are being bombarded, and the Westerners do not condemn this. They even support that. I mean, by words, by media, and also in practice. That's how they are. Of course, in Ukraine, we want the hostilities to stop. We don't want war to go on in Ukraine. We just want it to stop. But the remedy to any crisis is solely possible if you identify the root of the crisis. The root of the crisis in Ukraine is the U.S. policies, is the Westerners' policies. So this is the root of the problem. You need to identify them in the first place, and then accordingly, you can pass judgment, and if you can take action, then you take action accordingly. Okay, we're speaking of Ukraine. There are also some lessons that can be learned. You know, you see some speakers and writers mention some of these points. I want to mention a couple of them for you. One being that the support lent by Western powers for the people, for their stooges and their puppet regimes. This is only a mirage. It's not reality. All governments and states should realize this. Those states that feel they have the backing of the U.S. and Europeans, see what happened in Ukraine and yesterday what happened in Afghanistan. The president of Ukraine, a few days ago, he said the same thing, and also the Afghan former president also said the same thing, that we put our trust in America. We had our trust in Western governments, and they just left us alone. They left us high and dry. You cannot trust these people. This is the first lesson to learn. Not the Islamic Republic. You know, everybody has heard about Iran's independence and freedom, but those who are depending on America, they need to draw this lesson from these developments, and they should realize and come to terms with realities. Now, the second lesson to be drawn is that the people are the biggest supporters of governments. If people had entered this stage in Ukraine, the situation of the Ukrainian government wouldn't be so easy, because people were not there. People were not on the stage because they didn't recognize the government. Just like the time when America attacked the Saddam era Iraq, people did not defend their country. People were pushed, standing idle by, and then America got dominant. But in the very same country, in Iraq, when Daesh attacked, the people went on the stage, and Daesh, that was a very big menace. The Iraqi people were able to push them back because they were there on the battlefront. It's the people. People are the main factor for independence of countries. So we have experienced this ourselves in the Iraq-imposed war, the whole of defense era. The people were there on the stage. People pitched in. And then, despite the fact that big powers and superpowers backed Saddam Hussein and helped him in different ways, the Islamic Republic of Iran, with the help of its people, managed to leave the enemy in failure. That is, this is another lesson that we need to learn. Hopefully we could open our eyes, we could open up our ears and think properly, see properly, and take action properly, so we'll be able to also benefit from these points and lessons. May Almighty God elevate the status of the late Imam Khomeini. These are the lessons that he taught us. He was the one who made us move on this in this direction. Hopefully the pure souls of our martyrs would get united with the soul of the Prophet Muhammad. They brought us pride in this world. Once again, I would like to offer felicitations and blessings be upon Imam Mahdi, peace be upon him. And that's the end of the speech.
Well, there you have it. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressing the Iranian nation and Muslims around the world.
Well, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, what you heard was the speech of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the auspicious occasion of Eid Mab'ath. Well, during this speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, Prophet Muhammad managed to unite people after they embraced Islam as a religion. The leader said Iranians managed to eradicate absolute monarchy, which was supported by the United States and the UK. The leader said Prophet Muhammad was chosen by Allah to fight all types of ignorance in Arabia Desert. He said Western society uses science and knowledge to slaughter people and plunder other nations. The leader of the Islamic Revolution said Western civilization today is suffering from modern ignorance, adding that Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei lauded Kashmiri Muslims for punishing those who insulted Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed U.S. government as mafia regime. The leader of the Islamic Revolution said such mafia regime in U.S. needs to create crises globally and West Asia in particular. The leader also blamed the United States for crisis in Ukraine. The leader slammed U.S. for plundering oil resources in Eastern Asia and stealing Afghan assets. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Westerners support killing Yemeni people, but they call for end to Ukraine crisis. During this speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution said both Ukraine president and ex-Afghan president Ashraf Ghani acknowledged that the United States left them alone. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, many thanks for being with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its fourth day, with fighting expanding to more areas across the country. While Russia says so far it has hit over 1,000 Ukrainian military sites, Kiev says Moscow is losing its initiative in the attack and has suffered heavy losses. Meanwhile, EU leaders are discussing more sanctions on Russia and Belarus, and now also providing Ukraine with military assistance is on the table. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will try to find out how the situation escalated to this point, and with the Ukrainian government agreeing to hold unconditional talks with Russia, whether we can hope that a peace deal could be on the horizon. But before we begin, let's bring in our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, to get some updates from the EU. Jerome?
That's right. Yes, Gisu. Well, I'm here at the Council of the EU in Brussels, where the Home Affairs Ministers have been meeting to discuss plans to try and take in asylum seekers coming from Ukraine. Of course, they're mainly going into Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. And these EU countries, the governments there are traditionally well known to being anti-refugees. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But also happening at the moment is a virtual online meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers. And they are rubber stamping new proposals put forward by Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the Commission, earlier. It talks about, you know, banning Russia Today and Sputnik, so media outlets in Russia, banning them here in the EU. Also, more or less banning the aviation industry. It'll be a no-fly zone for the Russian aircraft over the EU, the entire EU. They cannot land or take off. Also, some of the major banks are being taken out of the SWIFT payment transaction system. But most importantly, as you mentioned in the introduction, the EU is officially for the first time as a 27-nation bloc actually going to finance the funding of deadly weapons into a conflict into Ukraine. So the big question there is, how might Russia react? Could this spiral out of control altogether? Because in fairness, these really are the hardest sanctions ever put forward by the EU. And when you add on to that the sort of the direct military intervention from the European Union itself as a whole, and the United States as well, and the UK, obviously citizens are watching out to see how this might escalate or how it might pan out.
Thank you very much, Jerome. And that, of course, is one of the questions that we will have our guests respond to. Now, to continue this discussion, we are joined by Mr. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joining us live from Hamilton. And also, we have with us Alicia Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who is joining us live from Brussels. Now, in order to begin our discussion, we'll start with Mr. Alicia Magnier, who is joining us. Alicia, Russia has said that the main reason for this military operation is NATO's eastward expansion and its security concerns. So we could safely say that NATO is at least partly to blame for where we are right now. Why is the EU aggravating the situation by getting involved militarily?
Well, first of all, yes, it is the presence of NATO all along the Russian borders, and particularly in most of the former Soviet Union countries, and at the exception of Ukraine and Georgia, of course. And because NATO said that it has looked into the acceptance of the candidateship of Ukraine and Georgia, this is where the Russian President Vladimir Putin is reacting today and is saying, you cannot accept the membership of Ukraine and Georgia or enable Ukraine to become a nuclear power country because it presents a serious danger to the national security of my country. And in 1990, when during the perestroika, U.S. Secretary James Baker promised President Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO will not move an inch from its current position in 1990 and will not move into the former Soviet Republic. In 1993, U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher did exactly the same with President Boris Yeltsin, who sent a letter to Bill Clinton at that time saying that NATO and Russia should establish a friendly relationship However, NATO should not move in the form of a Soviet Republic. And Christopher promised President Yeltsin that NATO will not do that. So, but however, we saw in 1999 that these verbal promises, not written promises, but verbal promises that were shown by the U.S. National Security Archive and by the memoir of Secretary Christopher in his book, and also in other sources within the U.S. administration at that time who lengthily wrote about it, including the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl at that time. They all said that this is what was a verbal promise. Now, Russia was too weak to maintain, to react to the Americans when they broke their promises, which is something that the world is used to, because we've seen the Americans breaking their promises, even written agreement, and I call upon only the JCPOA in 2018 by President Donald Trump, and did not respect the agreement with Russia. And now Russia has become much stronger, is ready for the sanction, is ready to claim its right, and is ready to tell to the Americans, you cannot install strategic missiles that can carry nuclear warhead on the borders of Russia and the former Soviet Union that need only a few minutes to reach Moscow or to any other nearby city close to the border. So this is the reaction of President Putin by walking into Ukraine, and he's not saying that he wants to remove President Zelensky. He's saying, I want an agreement and I want a document that states that Ukraine will remain neutral, exactly like Finland agreement in 1953. He wants all the former Soviet Union to sign the same agreement because he can see that NATO is behaving in an aggressive way, expanding its control and its presence along the borders with Russia and installing nuclear missile in every country that is moving in. This is what this is about. It exactly. is not, we see the consequences of what President Putin is doing, but we look at the origin of the whole problem.
Exactly. So as you mentioned so yourself, and let's bring in Mr. Ken Stone to continue this right now. As Alicia mentioned, the U.S. and NATO clearly disregarded Russia's security concern, and they, in a way, paved the way for the situation we are in right now. So at this point, we don't see any efforts from their part to de-escalate the situation. Is there anything that they find in their best interest in what's going on right now? Were they planning for this to happen?
Indeed, they were planning for this to happen. And by this, I mean the eastward expansion of NATO right up to Russia's borders. Your other guest, Monsieur Magnier, explained the history here very well, and I won't try and elaborate on it. But clearly the plan is and remains to encircle Russia and to push NATO right up to the borders of Russia on in every space along the border where they can. And the purpose of this is to augment U.S. hegemony over the entire European continent. Once they get up to the borders of Russia, of course, I feel that they would try and do exactly what they tried to do in Syria and in Libya, Iraq, and many other countries, and that is to balkanize the what's left of Russia, and they would turn it into small nationalist governments that would be too weak to resist the U.S. And this is exactly what happened when NATO attacked and bombed Yugoslavia in 1999, 72 days of bombing, 30,000 bombs, and they destroyed the country of Yugoslavia, which was the only success story of the First World War. And that's their plan for Russia. So the U.S. was planning this. But now Mr. Putin has foiled their plan. He has drawn the line. He drew a red line at Ukraine, and now he is going to insist that Ukraine be independent, be neutral, rather, and that it be demilitarized and denazified. And these were all, this could have been settled peacefully when Russia came with proposals on December 21st, 2021, by sending draft treaties to the U.S. and NATO, asking for reasonable security guarantees for Russia, because Russia understands that security is indivisible, and you can't have security for one country at the expense of another. So they asked for reasonable security guarantees, and one of them was that Ukraine become neutral, and they get an ironclad guarantee that it would never join NATO. This was a very reasonable proposition, but the U.S. and NATO just cast aside their demands. And then a few days later, Mr. Zelensky said that he was no longer interested in the Minsk protocols, which he was required to negotiate with the breakaway republics and to restore their language and cultural rights and their former autonomy that they lost when the U.S. staged a coup in 2014 and stole democracy from Ukraine and instead brought in a junta riddled with Nazi parties, and I mean real Nazi parties, the same ones that allied with Hitler in World War II, and with Nazi elements in its police and in its army. So this is the result of 30 years of westward aggressive expansion by NATO, which is not a defensive alliance. It's an offensive alliance of the United States. It was set up by the Prime Minister of Canada at his insistence in 1949, that was Lester Pearson. It was to protect the North Atlantic countries from the alleged threat of communism. Well, when the Soviet Union dissolved itself in 1991, NATO should have dissolved itself as well. And it didn't. And this is what we're stuck with today. An aggressive military alliance pushing toward the heart of Russia stopped at the borders of Ukraine by Mr. Putin
exactly.
And the Russian Federation.
And still making aggressive statements, according to Mr. Putin, who has ordered Russia's nuclear deterrent forces on alert in response to those aggressive statements by NATO. So let's bring in Mr. Manier. What could this implicate, this nuclear deterrent forces on alert?
Well, it's extremely serious, because when we hear all the European countries saying that we are going to send defensive and offensive weapons to Ukraine, and we hear for the first time the president of the European Commission saying that we are thinking of supporting a very large credit for Ukraine to buy weapons and supply it with the necessary weapons. This is a kind of a declaration of war from the side of Europe against Russia. However, we know here in Europe that the Europeans consider Russia as a partner. 40% of their gas comes from Russia. There is a very strong economic and financial relationship between Russia and Europe. There are 4,000 companies, European companies, working in Russia, of which at least 450 only French companies are working in Russia. And Europe would freeze without the Russian gas. The Americans, the Qatari, Algeria, Azerbaijan, nobody can replace the Russian gas, particularly at this time of the year, and even for at least the next year. Therefore, all these moves that are registered by Europe are not European decisions. They are NATO-driven. They are supported by the U.S. It is the U.S. that is dictating its policy on Europe and pushing Europe into conflict. And this has started in 2018, when the French President Emmanuel Macron said, we want the European army to defend ourselves from all the threat that can that Europe can face, including the one that comes from the United States. So NATO is saying, we are the army of Europe. We are the army that you need. However, it is establishing nuclear power, nuclear missile on the continent to face Russia when Russia is not the enemy. And in case of nuclear war between the United States and Russia, the first missile will be launched from the continent, not from the United States. And this is all, what is all about it. It is for the Americans to make sure that the Russian cannot have the possibility to intercept these missiles and to react in case of nuclear war. So by installing nuclear missiles in Ukraine or enabling Ukraine to become a nuclear power, Russia will be completely hopeless, and these nuclear missiles will reach Russia in no time without the possibility to defend itself in case of nuclear war between the West and Russia, or particularly the U.S. and Russia. So the whole thinking is orientated toward the war and not toward prosperity, not toward supporting the economy. And we hear Biden saying he's asking the Congress for $6.5 billion to offer for the refugees that are coming from Ukraine and to support Ukraine military apparatus. We never hear him saying we are going to offer $6.5 billion for the American people or for the poor people in Asia or in Africa or in the Middle East or wherever for humanitarian objective. It's only for war and for immigrant or for the immigration and the exodus of European citizens coming from either the former Yugoslavia and now from Ukraine coming toward Europe or to any other places. So why triggering all that from the first beginning and not give Russia this paper where you guarantee that there is no threat against its security? And this is it. And we end all this tension and this unnecessary war in Ukraine.
Exactly. And now the Ukrainian president has agreed to meet with Russians without preconditions, that is. So, Mr. Stone, could we be hopeful that this might lead to a peace deal?
Yes, I think so. I think that it would be wise for Mr. Zelensky to end the resistance by Ukrainian forces, which is hopeless anyway, because the Russian armed forces have a huge military superiority and have already knocked out most of Ukraine's ability to resist. So continuing this war, well, put it the other way, finding a peace deal would save a lot of lives, and it would save a lot of damage to civilian infrastructure. But we have to keep in mind what it is that a peace deal must have as its basis. And I know that the Russian government will take nothing less than a change in the status of the Ukrainian government to one that is neutral, and one that is a country that is demilitarized and denazified. So I'm not sure if Mr. Zelensky will agree to that or can agree to that. He was the peace candidate in the election in Ukraine a couple of years later. He promised to settle the dispute in the Donbass, and he didn't. He entered negotiations through the Minsk protocols, but in the last few weeks he said he gave up on the Minsk protocols, and so the war continued, provoking this situation. He also was elected to bring peace and good relations between Ukraine and Russia. And he failed to do that as well, because he continued to accept the actual gradual infiltration of NATO into Ukraine. He accepted arms from Canada, money from Canada. I'm just saying Canada right now. He accepted military trainers. He accepted warships from Canada and the Black Sea. This is just Canada. And a special forces stationed there from Canada. So That doesn't include from the U.S. and other countries of NATO and the European Union. So it was a progressive NATOification, NATOification of Ukraine that Mr. Zelensky was presiding over. And if there's going to be a peace deal, all of that will have to be reversed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stone. And Mr. Manier, the final question, we're running out of time, so if you could please wrap it up very quickly. China has been backing Russia. Can we expect an alliance to form here? Are we looking at a new world order, basically?
New world order if President Putin ends this war very quickly. Now, we know that today there is a Russian and Ukrainian delegation that went to Belarusia to start the negotiation. That's a good step. We don't think that this is going to succeed from the first meeting. We think that there are many meetings that are required, and the Ukrainians are negotiating under the fire. However, if Mr. Putin manages to win this war very quickly and end it without a lot of losses, then there is a new order, and the part of the world that is looking as an alternative to the US hegemony will turn against Russia and will be supported by Russia.
Thank you very much. And quickly, Mr. Stone, your opinion on this? Are we looking at a new world order?
Well, I think actually it's the end of the U.S. World order, the world order where the U.S. was a unipolar hegemon and there was no opposition to it. And that occurred since in 1991 when the former Soviet Union disbanded itself. What I think is that what we're going to see now is not necessarily a formal alliance between Russia and China, but an understanding that they need to stand together against the aggressive completely illegal expansion of the of NATO, not just in Europe. It's all over the world. It's in Africa. It's in Latin America. It's in Asia. So I think that we are looking at a change in the balance of power in the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War out of Hamilton, and also Mr. Elijah Manier, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us. And thanks for following this edition of The Spotlight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture. We know that Islam says that if someone needs a house, it is necessary to him to have a house. And initially, in the early time in the Islam, we can see that whenever a couple used to marry, like a man or a woman, when they used to marry, the other people or the neighbors or the parents, they used to help them in making a house separately if they needed that. So the people, they were all helping each other, and they used to manage to make a house or build a house for this new couple. And therefore, Islam also emphasizes on such thing. On the other hand, we can see that in today's world, we have a lot of issues. For example, the people where they are hungry, they do not have anything to eat, they are facing the thirst, they are facing the, the being hunger, they are facing the hardship in their life. And on top of that, there is another issue, which is the rent. And they are forced, obviously, according to today's system, according to this capitalist system that we have today in this world, the people, they are obviously, they have to pay this rent in order to have a proper place to live, which shouldn't be this way, because it is the capitalist system. In the capitalism, the person who owns the house is earning through any means he wants, and there is no idea of charity or helping people or the social life. Therefore, people, general people, are suffering from such ideas. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture. And we said that, unfortunately, in today's world, due to the system which is running the whole world, which is known as capitalism, due to that, people are suffering from the housing issues. They do not have house. They have to pay heavy rents. And on top of that, the houses are not according to their needs. So they are only getting the house which they can basically, they can pay off, or they can pay the rent, which they can pay its rent. That is the criteria of choosing a house in today's world. And it is not according to the needs of the person. So we need to look at the Islamic teachings, because Islamic teaching says that this house which you need to live, according to the Islamic teachings, where you can follow your religion, where you can have peace and happiness in your life, it should be in a way that it should be enough for you. And on top of that, it should have some place for you to enjoy your life. So therefore, when we look at the Islamic point of view of choosing a house, Islam emphasizes on this. But on the other hand, Islam also stops us from oppressing someone. So we need to help. We have infaq in the religion. We have this feeling of helping others in the religion. And the rewards are near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we need to help each other in order to provide a better house, a shelter for the others as well, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.